This year marks the 50th anniversary of the death of one of the pioneers of the environmental movement, Rachel Carson. Her landmark exposé, Silent Spring, woke people up to the dangers of pesticides. But she was actually something of a reluctant activist. She preferred walking the seashore and exploring tide pools to political agitation. Rob Nixon is a scholar and environmental writer, and he holds the Rachel Carson Chair in English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He recently reread all of Rachel Carson's writing, and he told Steve Paulson he was struck by her remarkable range.
She began really as a lyricist of the ocean. She wrote a trilogy of books, Under the Sea Wind, The Sea Around Us, and The Edge of the Sea, that really established her.
And she had been a marine biologist, right?
That's right, yes. I also had encountered Carson in sequence. As a teenager growing up in South Africa, I'd come across The Edge of the Sea, and I lived on the edge of the sea, 10 minutes from the Indian Ocean, and the sea was my kind of saving grace in a very conservative, rather fierce culture. And I just loved what she saw. I loved her curiosity, her wonder, and I had had a childhood very much immersed in the sea. And it was not until many years later, in fact, after I immigrated to America in my 20s, that I read Silent Spring.
Which was a much more political book.
A much more political book, a much darker book. It's full of elegy, mourning, apocalypse, prophetic warnings, polemics.
And of course, this is her account of how environmental toxins like DDT were wrecking the environment.
Yes, exactly. And so one of the things that I began to think about was this question of courage and wonder, because it took a lot of courage for her to break with her voice, break with her subject. And indeed, Dorothy Freeman, who was her great friend and indeed the great love of her life, warned her at the time. She was absolutely aghast. She said, "You're going to lose your audience, you're going to get depressed, and people will never hear from you again." And an interesting remark I came across in that reading was a remark that Carson made, where she said that she wasn't only doing it for society, but for her own future peace, that if she remained silent, she couldn't be at peace with herself.
So, I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, really, what you're describing is a person who loved being outdoors, especially loved being by the sea.
Yes.
And then she came to a point where she realized, you know, I have to do more than just revel in the glory of nature. I have to engage in politics because there are real threats out there that are destroying what I love.
Absolutely. And she wasn't only passionate about being by the sea, but being in the sea. She's pottering about in tide pools. And my favorite photo of her is bent over with the water halfway up her calves, just peering down into a pool. And she and her friend Dorothy, that's what they love to do, to mingle a childhood curiosity with a scientific sense of wonder as well.
Hmm. Now, I know you brought in a few passages from Rachel Carson's writing. And do you have one that would reflect some of this?
Yes, I do. One of the interesting things about Carson is that she grew up in rural Pennsylvania, not far from Pittsburgh, a very long way from the ocean. But early on, something in her was seeded, a passion for the ocean that led her ultimately to marine biology. So I'm just reading from an essay she wrote in 1951. "I seem to have been born with a fascination for the ocean. For years before I had ever seen it, I thought about it and dreamt about it, and try to picture what it would be like. I loved Swinburne and Masefield and all the other great poets of the sea. The stories I wrote for my classes in English composition often had a marine background. After I became interested in biology as a college student, I very naturally came to specialize in marine biology. At the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, I had my first prolonged contact with the sea. There I never tired of watching the tidal currents pouring through the hole and the waves breaking on Nobska Point after a storm. It was there, too, that I first discovered the rich scientific literature of the sea. But it is fair to say that my first impressions of the sea were sensory and emotional, and that the intellectual response came later."
Oh, that's lovely. And it's worth pointing out that Rachel Carson was one of the great writers about wonder. the experience of wonder. In fact, she wrote a book about wonder.
She was originally going to be an English major, and so it was the poetry of the sea that got her first. But that led her to a scientific fascination. Towards the end of her life, after the success of Silent Spring, but also after she was very ill and she knew her time on Earth was limited, she started writing a book introducing children to wonder, because she realized if you can get children to observe passionately, to immerse themselves in the natural world, that is the beginning of all sorts of things, leading, among other things, very often to scientific careers.
Now, there's a tragic element to Rachel Carson's life as well. She became very sick, and I don't know if it was while she was writing Silent Spring. And I mean, there's sort of a terrible, I don't know if irony is the right word. I mean, she's writing about environmental toxins, and she develops breast cancer at that very moment.
Yes. So she battled. She really battled with writing through that, and she had rheumatism and various other afflictions, heart disease, and it was a struggle, particularly towards the end.
What was the reaction when Silent Spring was published in, 1962?
It was immense. Partly for the book itself, but there was also a PBS documentary that came out shortly that was, I think, watched simultaneously by 1 in 10 Americans, which is absolutely huge. President Kennedy acknowledged it. There's no question that it contributed a great deal to the forming of the EPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act.
Wasn't she also attacked by the big chemical companies?
Was,
I mean, DuPont, Dow, Monsanto.
Right. DuPont, Dow, Monsanto, Velsicol. And this was a time when I think 1% of tenured scientists in America were women. So she was very, very vulnerable on that front. One review that I recall by a professor at Vanderbilt, in the medical school at Vanderbilt, the title of the review was Silent Miss Carson.
Keep quiet. Yeah, shut up.
Absolutely. And a former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture said, how can a spinster possibly be interested in genetics? She's probably a communist. So the fact that she was a woman, the fact that she was not married, the fact that she did not have children were all wielded against her.
Recently, you went to South Africa to participate in a symposium, give a series of talks on Rachel Carson, 50 years after Silent Spring was published. Does she have much of a following in South Africa?
You know, one of the interesting things about Carson is that Silent Spring in particular has resonated in so many different contexts, in so many different worlds. Even though the science has moved on since the 60s, there are certain issues that she raised that resonate, like the question of environmental justice, unequal exposure to risk, unequal access to resources. Those are very contemporary issues.
The fact that the poor tend to be much more exposed to these environmental problems than the rich.
Absolutely. Another aspect to this journey I took through Carson's writings was that I just finished writing a book called Slow Violence and the Environmentalism of the Poor. And it had largely been inspired by Carson. I was writing about writer-activists engaged in environmental struggles in the global south, places like Nigeria, India, the Middle East. And I could sense the resonance that her work had in these different corners of the world. And I also came to appreciate more something that she wrote at one point, where she talked about the secret tension between love and despair. These activists in the global south were fighting extraordinary odds, and I was constantly searching for hope. And there were stories of hope, sometimes stories of martyrdom, people killed for their commitments.
Now, Rachel Carson died in April of 1964 at the age of 55. She was quite young when she died. I know you brought in another piece of writing by her, which was actually read at her memorial service. Could you read that?
Sure. And this is a letter that she wrote to Dorothy Freeman. It was one of the last things she wrote, and she was reminiscing about a wonderful September day they spent at the beach. I think it really captures her spirit and her sense of wonder. Most of all, I shall remember the monarch butterflies, that unhurried westward drift of one small winged form after another, each drawn by some invisible force, We talked a little about their migration, their life history. Did they return? We thought not. For most, at least, this was the closing journey of their lives. But it occurred to me this afternoon, remembering that it had been a happy spectacle, that we had felt no sadness when we spoke of the fact that there would be no return. And rightly, for when any living thing has come to the end of its life cycle, we accept that end as natural. For the monarch butterfly, that cycle is measured in a known span of months. For ourselves, the measure is something else. When that intangible cycle has run its course, it is a natural and not unhappy thing that a life comes to its end. That is what those brightly fluttering bits of life taught me this morning. I found a deep happiness in it. So I hope may you. Thank you for this morning.
That was a letter by Rachel Carson, read at her memorial service 50 years ago. Rob Nixon is the Rachel Carson Professor of English at the University of Wisconsin. He spoke with Steve Paulson.